Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Boy, howdy, ain't that the truth? Alan Adams joining us right here in studio on this Monday afternoon. Hey there, Alan.
Why, hello. How are you?
I'm good. You know why I'm good? Because, you know, we spent a lot of time together this weekend.
There was
show Friday night, a little soiree on Saturday. It was great.
Yeah, no, we, we got all up in other in each other's business.
Yes.
for a good long chunk of time there. It was good.
I enjoyed it tremendously. And we were talking in the break there about what a great time we had with our friends Michelle and Craig, a little focus group get together to wish them well on the first addition to their family.
Yep. I continue to cross my fingers that everything arrives when it's supposed to arrive, because hey man, there's nothing greater than a leap year birthday.
I think that would be so cool.
I love the idea of a leap day baby.
Yes.
So we'll hope it continues along that path.
And again, we marvel over the wonderful hostess work of Stella.
Yes. No. our dog does a lot of work to make sure that everybody is comfortable and happy. You know, it's we love having people. And obviously, Sheridan does so much wonderful work to make these sorts of things happen, for everybody. And so, you know, it's just like I was telling you off air, it's like, I basically just get pointed in directions, when necessary. But, as far as like the hard work, like she goes above and beyond.
Yeah, it was great. Wonderful time as always. And, here we are. Here we are on a Monday on the cusp of the Oscar nominations being announced tomorrow. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but you saw a couple films too that we want to talk about.
I did. A couple of streamers. It's I've talked about this before. I do have stretches where I miss my previous life, in terms of being officially employed to to review movies and whatnot. This time of year is a reminder that it's not all wine and roses,
right?
Because it is a particularly dumpy-wary this year. I had every intent of trying to get to the theaters to see something, and then I'm looking around and it's like, well, I mean, there are a couple of like sort of older films that are out that I'm like, oh, I should really see that, but you know, as far as new releases, yeah, it's a pretty barren landscape out there.
Yeah.
But we do have some stuff available on the various streaming services, which is nice. I watched a Netflix film called Lift. Stars Kevin Hart, among others. I guess you'd call it a heist comedy, but it wasn't particularly funny. but it seems like that was almost a deliberate choice. Like, it felt like they were really trying to make... I don't know if we're trying to just like get Kevin Hart to go legit or what, but it was weird.
Hmm.
It was weird. And it's like, and it's one of those things where like, I generally find him kind of annoying when he's doing his shtick.
Yes, me too.
But it's like, oh, it's hard to believe, but it actually might be worse when he's not doing the shtick.
Oh, Lord.
Cause there's, you're kind of, it's like, oh, like you were one note before. Now there are no notes. We are noteless.
Oh dear.
I did see. In addition, I saw a really quite lovely and occasionally moving documentary called June, which is currently streaming on Paramount Plus, and it's the story of the life of June Carter Cash, which there's a lot that I certainly didn't know about her life. Mm. Because it was a long and richly lived one.
Yeah.
You know, and she's so much more than, you know, Johnny Cash's wife. And I think that
right.
in a lot of ways that's sort of been, you know, that's the easy label to put on her, but she was so much more than that. So yeah, which one of those would you like to talk about first?
Well, it's because I don't think we'll have to spend too much time on it. Let's talk about Lift first.
We will indeed not have to spend very much time on it. Directed by F. Gary Gray, who did, among other things, Straight Outta Compton. And it stars Kevin Hart, who also produces. There's Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Vincent D'Onofrio, Billy Magnuson, Jean Renault, Sam Worthington. It's not a bad cast, but yeah, it's basically... how do I describe this? It's like if you took Ocean's 11 and made everyone like 10% as cool, and even less charming, you'd kind of be in the ballpark. Wow. It's a heist movie. Kevin Hart plays a guy named Cyrus, who is the head of a gang of international art thieves. But there's the weird morality where it's like, oh, we only steal stuff from people who don't deserve to have it, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, okay. So this crew comes together, puts together elaborate schemes to steal artworks, resell them, and then, it's kind of Robin Hood, except, the poor that they give to is themselves, I guess. Anyway, so they're being tracked by Interpol. They're trying to nail this ring of art thieves. They've been working on it for years. But then a bigger fish turns up. There's a billionaire financier who has some questionable moral leanings and is planning on engaging the services of some hacker group to flood things. It's very unclear what the plan is, but somehow it's a lot of people are going to get hurt, and our billionaire is going to make even more money. Rather than capturing the art thieves, they're enlisted to pull off the biggest lift yet. See, that's what they don't call it. Heist. They call it a lift.
Lift. Got
so,
it.
In case you forget that, Kevin Hart reminds you approximately every 10 minutes or so over the course of the movie that we call these lifts. And so we get this wildly convoluted and elaborate plan to steal what turns out to be $500 million in gold. Look, man, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it was fine, I guess. Like, I will say, I poo-poo Netflix as much as anyone. They are not afraid to send their folks all over the world to film. Like, no, but like Brussels and Tuscany and London, and like, they're really in these places. Mm. Like, they're really filming there. And for what it's worth, this one does not have nearly the notorious Netflix sheen that a lot of these films do. I think that's about what I can say about it. Look, it's like, if you like disposable cinema, like it's a perfectly good movie to have on in the background while you do something else. You don't really have to pay attention. It has its charming moments, largely from the supporting cast. Our leads don't have a particularly large amount of chemistry, but again, like, yeah, it's fine, I guess.
So much for lift. You're bringing me down. You're not lifting me. Let's talk about June then instead.
Okay. This is a good movie.
Okay.
It's a real effort to sort of unpack, what is frankly a large, like, I don't want to say forgotten legacy, but there was, like, when you hear the name June Carter, it's like, oh, it's, Johnny Cash's wife, they were married. But I mean, she lived so much life before that and during that. And some of the stories that come out in this documentary are really fascinating. Now, the framing device, such as it is they basically build the film around archival recordings from when June Carter Cash recorded a solo album in 1998. Her first solo album, I want to say they said it was like 25 years or something like that. And this took place in 1998. So that's the sort of the foundation, I guess, of the film. But we really go right from the beginning, from like her early days, like when she started, singing with the Carter family, when she was, she was just a kid. She was like 6 years old when she started performing in front of people, and they traveled the country, and they especially, like, they were among the first to really hit hard, like the border stations down in Texas to try to to elevate their profile that way. So they played a lot of Mexican radio stations and all that stuff, and really sort of, I think, opened that up as an avenue in a way that hadn't really happened before. You know, and then she, you know, as she grew older, like, she and her sisters, along with their mother, who, again, like, it was just an absolutely legendary musician.
Mother,
like,
Maybelle, yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, but I didn't know any of that, you know? Just, like, you know, it's like there's this footage of her just absolutely shredding on the guitar, and it's just like, oh, this little like demure lady just absolutely wailing, and you're just like, okay, this is what we're talking about here. She got older. She started working at the Grand Ole Opry, where she met and married her first husband, Carl Smith.
Yeah. Yep,
had her first two children, and you know, started performing at the Opry both as a musician, but also like as kind of a comedian, and like and really proved herself to be a very well-rounded sort of performer. And that was one of the general sort of overarching themes throughout this film, is talking about how multi-talented she was. And so, you know, she's doing this stuff. She's working at the, you know, Grand Ole Opry with her husband. And then, you know, in the mid-50s, this is, they get divorced. And that was not something that happened back in those days,
right.
You know, especially for people raised, you know, very conservatively Christian, like she was. But they divorced, but they kept working together. Like,
yeah,
that's the
yeah.
thing. Like, it's like, and their whole shtick was around this sort of like flirty, combative kind of thing. Yeah. And the
George and Tammy before George and Tammy,
you know, and the idea of doing that with someone when you have this sort of fresh, like, heartbreak, it's just indicative of what kind of like professional she was. But, you know, then, you know, there was a stretch where she was basically living in New York and flying back to do the Opry on weekends, because I didn't know this, and this blew my mind. She was an early student of Sanford Meisner at the Playhouse in New York.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
No clue. And it's like, and you know, and she was quite good apparently. And, you know, and so she, you know, she was trying to become an actor, and she did a lot of like small TV roles and stuff like that, and really sort of like was sort of developing that side of her career. Then she got pregnant again and got married again, and that sort of curtailed those particular dreams, because she had to make a living, and her second husband, whose name was Rip something. I forget. But he was like a mechanic and like a speedboat racer with zero to do with the entertainment industry. And it's just like, oh, you know, it's just, you don't know how people fall into these sorts of things. It was a fairly short marriage. And then she went back out, and then she started touring with Johnny Cash. And, you know, for years, it was pretty, you know, it was just basically like a platonic like friendship. And then, as she herself says in the film, she talks about how she sort of like looked around one day and like, oh God, I'm in love with Johnny Cash.
She fell into a burning ring of fire,
right? A song which, by the way, she wrote.
Yeah.
Which is something that a lot of people don't know. Like, it's, you know, it's such an iconic Johnny Cash tune that people don't.
And it's all about that. All about them falling in love when they're not supposed to.
Right. And so their relationship builds, and they finally wind up getting married. They actually, you know, his marriage breaks up. And so they have this blended family of, I believe, six daughters. Like, she had two daughters and he had four daughters. When they got together, she had been told she couldn't have any more children. And so when she got pregnant and they had John Carter, that was kind of a big deal. Like, it was very, you know, she was on the older side. And so for that to happen was really pretty exciting. And so then we get to see, as you know, that stretch in the late 60s and early 70s, when Johnny Cash was one of the most famous people on the planet.
Oh, a television show that was so ahead of its time.
You know, just massive, like, you know, selling out arenas, top 10 show on television, like, you know, number one albums, like the whole shebang, you know, and they're, they're moving into their giant house and like they're doing this thing. And everyone is just talking about how, you know, it's like the first 10 years, it was perfect, as close to a perfect like marriage as anyone, any of them had ever like seen. The 80s come along. He kind of falls from favor a little bit. His addiction issues rear their head again. And so there are some struggles there. But then, and you probably, you're more tuned into this sort of thing than I am. So you probably knew about this, but, there was this whole section of the film where they talk about, her as this sort of matriarchal figure where, they would just have like all these musicians, old timers, up and comers just come to their house and they would just basically do like a songwriter circle in their basement.
Wow.
Where it was just like, if someone had a new song that they wanted to like, they wanted to get feedback on, they would play it, you know, in this group. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, Roy Orbison was always there because he was our neighbor. And then it's like, oh, and, you know, and, you know, the first time that anyone heard Lay Lady Lay by Bob Dylan was in this basement. Jeez. And, and she's like, you know, she's telling like Chris Christopherson's wife, just like, you know, he might have something.
Yeah.
You know, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, like all these incredible like musical figures, and they're all just like jamming in the basement. And so so we see that sort of side of things as well. And then there's the sort of the rebound with the Highwaymen, which is, yeah, you know, kind of sprang from those you know, those sessions,
right,
because it was Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Chris Christopherson, along with Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
You know, and so they basically, like, from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, like, that was, they were just on the road.
Yeah.
But that also meant that June kind of got backseated in a way that she hadn't really been before. Didn't seem to be, like, and again, like, you never know with these sorts of films, but it did not seem like there was a lot of resentment as far as that goes. But I think it's also fair to say that she still had that desire to, you know, put, you know, to have her own voice heard.
Right.
And that's what sort of led to them putting together this solo album that John Carter actually co-produced. It was one of the first things that he worked on. And then we sort of follow through the year. It was, I think it was just 5 years after that she passed. Man, I tell you what, the footage of the funeral, it's heartbreaking. Yeah. It's heartbreaking to watch. You know, it was one of those things where everyone was just, okay, how long before Johnny goes? And it was, I think, 4 months or something, yeah, like that. It was not very long.
And he was, they were both fairly young, right? Very, very early 70s, maybe.
Yeah. They weren't, they certainly weren't like, incredible. They weren't that old, but I mean, I feel like the, yeah, years, the hard years,
yeah, so
you,
yes,
know, particularly in Johnny's case, but yeah, so it's just, it was this wonderful sort of look at someone, you know, it's a name I know, you know, I knew a couple of songs or whatever, but to just get this sort of more in-depth look at someone's life, it was really fascinating. So yeah, June on Paramount Plus, if you have any interest in that era of music, that genre of music, or just, I mean, just well-made documentary, like, you should check it out.
I'm looking forward to that. All right, let's talk a little Oscars. Tomorrow morning, they'll announce the Oscar nominees. What do you think?
It's, you know, it's a tough one this year. I mean, I think, well, I say that. I think it's going to be a top-heavy year as far as both in terms of nominations and in terms of wins. I think there are a handful of films that are probably going to make a lot of noise. Obviously, Oppenheimer seems to be the clubhouse leader in a lot of these categories. Barbie, of course, Killers of the Flower Moon. And then, you know, those are the big three, I think. And then you sort of, you kind of fall into a bit of a middle ground where it's, you're not sure. Like those three will all be Best Picture nominees. I think you'll see Maestro get a nomination, The Holdovers.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but, man, I tell you what, like, American Fiction is getting a lot,
yes,
of late, yeah, love for, yep, this, both in terms of for the film writ large. I think the screenplay And also Jeffrey Wright's performance is also generating a lot of
The Emma Stone film.
Poor Things. Yep. That's one that's going to get a lot of nods, I think, both in terms of in front of and behind the camera. And then one of the things I saw is people are starting to think that maybe we're going to see multiple international films in the best picture because I know people are talking. We saw at the Golden Globes, Anatomy of a Fall won a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And then The Zone of Interest, the Holocaust movie, is also generating a lot of buzz. And so the thought is that they, in a year like this one, when you are top heavy like that, it does perhaps give voters a little bit more flexibility to fill out their down ballot slots with stuff that's a little bit more of a reach. Simply because, it doesn't really matter, but we're all sort of at the point where it's probably going to be Oppenheimer, but if it's not, it's going to be, Killers of the Flower Moon, or perhaps, maybe Barbie makes a late charge and pulls it out. As far as the performance categories, I mentioned Jeffrey Wright, I think DiCaprio for Flower Moon. I think Giamatti for The Holdovers. It's going to be Cillian Murphy. Right, I can't imagine him not winning here, despite the fact that it's a pretty decent category this year. But still, on the actress side, I think Margot Robbie gets a nomination. Emma Stone, obviously, for Poor Things.
You think Gosling, by the way, gets a nomination?
For Barbie? I think for Best Supporting Actor, yeah. I think he's got a real shot.
Good.
Well, it's he's very good in the movie. Hollywood likes him.
Yeah.
Not gonna win, but no. But I think they'll very much want to get him sort of center of the frame. It'll be interesting too, because we're looking at in the supporting actor category, a lot of people are thinking Dafoe and Ruffalo for Poor Things, both getting nominated. Well, it sounds wild, but then I think it's the previous 3 years, I think, that category has had multiple people from the same film.
Right. Banshees
of Inisherin, yeah. Yep. And back through there. So it's certainly not outside the realm of possibility. Directorially, it's the usual suspects.
Yeah.
It's and Nolan, Lanthimos,
Greta Gerwig.
I think it's tough. I think it's a no-brainer to nominate her there, but it could be it's truncated enough where you could see someone like Gerwig or like Alexander Payne kind of getting forced out.
Right.
Depending on how many, how deep we want to go on some of these other films.
Does Bradley Cooper get a nod for best director, do you think?
It's one of those things where there have been a lot of people who have said a lot of nice things about Maestro, but no one seems to really be talking about the direction.
No. Yeah.
I think the performances are probably the ones. I think he's got a real shot at getting a Best Actor nod. I think Carey Mulligan is almost certainly going to get nominated for Best Actress. After that, I don't know how many other creative categories we're gonna see get rewarded like that. The interesting thing, there was the big fight about Barbie being. They pitched it as an original screenplay. The Academy would only accept it in the adapted category, which is, I guess I get it, because they did rely on significantly on the IP, but still, it felt like an original story to me. But I don't make the rules.
Does Wes Anderson get a nomination?
I don't think so.
No?
Which is crazy. It's crazy to me, but I don't know. I don't know that.
What about for screenplay? Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. That's probably where if they're going to give him something, yep. That's probably where it's going to be. And it's a bummer because I loved Asteroid City, but there's only so much you can do.
Right.
I suppose. And then, you know, you start getting venturing into the technical categories, and it will be interesting to see how, like what direction they want to go as far as how they reward those things. Like, oh, what did I see? Someone was talking about, don't be surprised to see like Napoleon get a lot of technical awards.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, I mean, okay, I guess.
Sure.
But yeah, it really just boils down to, you know, like, what do you expect from your production design? Like, what does best visual effects mean to you? Is it like big and bold? Is it more subtle? Mm. Is it somewhere in between? Like, do you reward innovation, or do you reward execution? Like, it's, who knows? Like, it feels Wild Westy in a way that it hasn't for a number of years, I think.
Now, I was reading a little bit over the weekend about this film. I haven't seen it. Past Lives.
Yes, Past Lives.
That's one that may be able to sneak in and get a nomination or two.
I think so. It's been really well received, and the truth is, the Academy tends to like to find a way to acknowledge these sort of more indie kind of underseen films if they can, to sort of balance out the sort of blockbustery side of things. And the truth is, like, you know, we're getting some pretty big box office players in the you know, in the Best Picture sort of race. Honestly, like, I mean, I don't know how Killers of the Flower Moon ended up doing at the box office, but, you know, Oppenheimer did $500 million and yeah. Barbie did $1 billion. You know what I mean? Like, these movies were extremely popular, and it will be interesting to see if the Academy rewards them as such, or if they do their Academy thing and pivot for the sake of pivoting and try to slide some sort of dark horse in there.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. Nominations announced tomorrow morning for the Oscars. And when's is the ceremony this year?
It's March 10th.
Oh,
so it's a little later this year than it's been in recent years. But I'll be honest with you, I haven't the slightest idea who's hosting.
Yeah, maybe they won't have a host this year.
I mean,
maybe they'll bring back Will Smith to host.
Oh man, give that poor son of a gun who bombed at the Golden Globes, give him another shot.
Oh, lordy, lordy. No more Joe Coy, please. Thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
Great to see you. Alan Adams talking movies with us here on Past the Popcorn's 544. We're back with the good, the bad, the ugly after this.
Sweats Tire is a family-owned business serving the community since 1966 with a wide variety of tires and